Counsel, you may resume.
Mr. Chief Justice.
I have about 5 minutes remaining.
Thank
Mr.
you,
sir.
May it please the court. As to the question of Robertson versus Wegman, the subject of the survival in that case was death caused by an extraneous cause, not by the actual claim brought. In other words, a person didn't die as a result of the claim. A claim was brought and the person died later on, and that question was left directly open. Also, the Louisiana statute, which was the subject of a survival case in Robertson, allowed for many people to bring the action, and including parents. So if we were operating under the Louisiana statute here, Joe Jones could bring a claim. The problem with Indiana, nobody can bring a survival
but
claim.
But it wasn't, the claim couldn't be brought in Robertson at all, could it? Because they just didn't happen to be that kind of a person around.
Right, there was nobody. But there was a lot of different people who could have brought the claim, including parents. As to the question of congressional intent and exclusivity, every time that the Congress has wanted the FTCA to be exclusive, they have specifically stated in the Act or in amendments, and I refer the Court to 28 U.S.C. 2679.
But that doesn't necessarily answer the question whether the Court should imply a cause of action.
No, not necessarily, but it's important to look to congressional intent to determine whether...
That's another reason for not implying it, maybe, if they thought it should be exclusive, but it's not the only reason for not having a implied action.
No, I would think that whether there's an equally effective remedy is the real question. But talking about congressional intent, not only did they specifically state so when they wanted it to be exclusive, as to a Bivens claim, the 1974 amendment specifically recognizes that Bivens, it's a counterpart to Bivens, and the Senate report specifically says that. The other thing about congressional intent is that Congress is in fact involved in negotiations with the Justice Department about making it exclusive, and in the course of that, there's all kinds of broad changes being made in the Act, so it will take up the question of deterrence and compensation. Both the government and the Congress have both agreed as it exists now, the FTCA is not equally effective.
You've spoken three or four times about it being equally effective. I assume you mean would be the most productive in terms of the survivors. Is that what you mean?
I would say would create a remedy that could redress the loss suffered by the decedent in this case.
Well, as a practical matter, and I suppose this is anyone's judgment, wouldn't a judgment for, let us say, $50,000 against the United States government be worth considerably more than a judgment in a much larger amount against four or five civil servants?
Well, it would maybe address the question of compensation, but the question of deterrence, which is one of the twin goals of suing under the Constitution, would not be accomplished because there's no deterrence to these men who have committed these violations of citizens' constitutional rights. The question of common law of survival, if the court looks to the Fifth Amendment, which says no one should be deprived of life without due process of law, how else could someone sue for damage, for the deprivation of life under the Fifth Amendment, if there wasn't, in fact, some recognition that there had to be some common law of survival? If you apply Indiana law, is there's a constitutional violation if the person lives, but if the person dies, there isn't. That seems to fly right into the face of the Fifth Amendment.
Of course, many statutes produce that result, do they not?
Your Honor, I would probably, but when we're talking about the enforcement of fundamental rights under the Fifth and Eighth Amendment, I would think a statute...
Sometimes the right, the difference between the constitutional right and the statutory right, in all practical terms, are virtually indistinguishable, are they not?
That would be true, and 1983 certainly enforces the constitutional rights, but if... We don't have such a statute here. We have a statute that's based on state negligence law. And when we're talking about enforcing constitutional rights, it's just not adequate. I also address the court to 28 U.S.C. 2676 of the Tort Claims Act, which recognizes that if you get a recovery against the government, You can't not sue against the individual employee, which recognizes that they are coexisting remedies, but you can't get double recovery. So if you go under the Tort Claims Act, you're precluded from going against the individual employee, which imports a recognition that you could choose either one, depending on, you know, what you thought was your interest in terms of deterrence compensation. Two other points I'd like to make.
I think your time has expired, Mr. Deutsch.
All right, thank you.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Geller?
Just one point, Mr. Chief Justice. The situation in this case is not at all like Bivens. In Bivens, there was absolutely no federal remedy because Congress hadn't amended the Tort Claims Act yet to include intentional torts. Secondly, the Court said in Bivens that state trespass and invasion of privacy laws were not adequate to compensate victims of Fourth Amendment violations because such state laws were often inconsistent or even hostile to the interests protected by the Fourth Amendment. Respondent here has never alleged, much less shown, why state malpractice laws are not adequate to compensate for the sorts of violations and injuries that occurred here.
Well, that was a great deal of the thrust of his argument this morning.
What do you mean no,
he
I
never
don't,
alleged it?
That's what I don't believe he,
all morning.
I don't believe that the respondent has shown what in Indiana, in the peculiarities of Indiana malpractice law, prevents full compensation for the sorts of injuries alleged in the complaint. We think that this is the sort of a case that the Court had in mind in Carey against Pyphus when it said that in some cases the interests protected by a particular branch of the common law of torts may parallel closely the interests protected by a particular constitutional right. Here we think there is that parallel, and therefore we don't think the Court should extend the implied constitutional damages action of Bivens.
Mr. Geller, do you think the implied Bivens-type constitutional remedy survived the enactment of the amendment to the Federal Tort Claims Act that made that type of suit available against the government?
I mean, the actual Bivens sort of action.
Yeah, well, Bivens facts itself.
Yes, that's, I think, a question quite similar to the one Mr. Justice White asked me. I think our argument, if accepted, might lead to that result, but it needn't because of what I just said. There, the state laws that would be picked up in the Tort Claims Act to cover trespasses or the sorts of invasions in Bivens, the Court said in Bivens were not adequate frequently to protect the Fourth Amendment interests at stake. So that, and I think that this might have been what Congress had in mind in the legislative history of the 74 amendments.
Well, Mr. Geller, suppose there had been no Federal Tort Claims Act and there was a Bivens action brought. Would you argue that just the existence of the malpractice remedy in Indiana would foreclose a...
No. There has to be, we think, a federal remedy.
Well, so there has to be an alternative remedy federal,
yes,
under federal law.
Yes, absolutely. That is our position,
sure.
And there is here.
Why, pray tell?
Because this is a
federal... There's an adequate remedy under state law.
Well,
why would you imply one?
It's a federal constitutional right, and we think that people who have that right violated should be entitled to a remedy in federal court. That was
The only remedy of the Federal Tort Claims Act is going to be by reference to the Indian law.
Yes, that's what Congress has chosen to do, but it's still a federal remedy.
Well, you said that your own client ought to be suable.
Congress, we think, has made that judgment in cases like this. That's correct. And we don't think in that situation there's any need for this court to extend the implied constitutional damage action that it recognized in Bivens.
Extend it? You mean extend it to this case?
Extend it to a situation where there
case
is an adequate...
another name? Is that what you mean by extending it?
Extend it to a situation that didn't exist in Bivens, which is that where there is a federal statutory remedy that's fully adequate. Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Nachman Corporation.